Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Stephen Long, and author of the novel There's a Somebody. Happy Monday from the Pacific Northwest. True to form, it's raining and three outside. Just a real privilege to talk with Phil Parages. And when I first heard of Phil and it was suggested that I contact him, his work sounds to me like the plot of a Tom Hanks movie. And I know something about it, but Phil, good morning. I'm going to let you kind of explain what you do.
When you said Tom Hanks movie, I thought immediately of some pirates coming out my... my stairwell and attacking my office.
No, go
not,
back
not that
further.
Movie.
Yeah.
I buy and sell and appraise rare books and illuminated manuscript material.
Yeah.
And I've been doing it for 35 years, and it's the kind of work that makes me feel almost as if I'm a glutton, because I enjoy what I do, and almost makes me feel like I'm selfish, because I know an awful lot of people go to work every day and they don't necessarily have the same kind of pleasure I do.
Mm-hmm. We see those people, you tell you, I think, of, again, of an actor maybe or whoever, an author, who gets to get up and do what they love to do every day, and what a blessing that is. I think that's probably what everyone is looking for. And again, I've read the Statesman's Journal article about how you came to this work, but rather than me blow it and have to have you correct me, how did you pick rare books as a career?
Okay, I'm a lapsed academic. I was working on a PhD at the University of Michigan in the 1970s. And I had finished all my coursework, and the dissertation I was working on had to do with restoration comedy. I was dealing with the comic plays that were produced in London in the 1660s. The theaters had been closed during the interregnum when the Puritans had taken over. Charles II was restored in 1660, and he was a theater goer. And he liked women, and women were on the stage for the first time in England, beginning in 1660. And it was a very exciting and provocative time, because women mostly were a lot like go-go girls. They didn't have much in the way of big parts, but they had an opportunity to show off their bodies. Anyway, for that and other reasons, I was interested in this material. And I got a teaching position in Kalamazoo. And Kalamazoo is a place where you can afford to buy a house, and so I bought a house, but I had no furniture, and I started going to garage sales. And one day in 1976, November, in a lower middle class house that had all the usual garage sale detritus, you know, towels and linens and glassware, in one small room, in one small corner, on one small table was a big stack of old books, and every one of those old books was a kind of ratty old Bible, except for one. And the one book that stood out was an architectural book that was printed in 1669 in London. And it was a book that told you how to make columns. It was a book that was intended for carpenters to be used on the job site. And it had 50 large format copper engravings of columns, of Ionic, Doric, Corinthian columns. And I didn't have much interest in architecture, but I did have an interest in material from this particular decade. And at that moment, I looked at that book as a cultural artifact, and it was the first time I had seen a book as a cultural artifact. Before that, they were always just repositories of information. And the woman wanted $45 for it, and I had no idea if that was, you know, a ridiculous price one way or another. All I knew was I was deeply in debt to the University of Michigan. But it just seemed of compelling interest to me. And after she and I bargained and she decided she would take $35 for it, I bought the book, And that's how the whole enterprise started. I then started asking around, you know, if there was some way to find out if this book had some value, and if it did, how much. And nice people helped me, which is the story of my life as a bookseller. And I found out that the book had been sold just one time that we could find a record of in the 20th century, and it had sold for $1,000. And
so that particular book, not copies of the book, but that book?
No, a different copy, one other copy.
Okay.
And actually, to be more precise, it had sold for a price that, given when it was sold and the binding it was in and the condition it was in, my copy looked like it ought to be worth $1,000. And this was exciting to me because I'd only paid $35 for it, and it seemed
sure.
like magic. And the rest of the beginning of the story, once I found this out, I started asking around who would buy this from me. And I was told there was a man named Jeffrey Steele who lived in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and he was the dean of architectural booksellers in America.
Really?
So I wrote him a long letter and described this book I had, and I said, do you want to buy it for $1,000? And he said, come see me. And I went to see him, and he looked like the little banker on the Monopoly card, you know, had the short guy with the mustache. And
sure.
He was avuncular and patrician, and he showed me his home, which also had, you know, beautiful columns on it. And it was full of these big architectural tomes, and it was clear that he was making a living selling beautiful books from his home. Anyway, he bought the book right away for $1,000. And then I said to him something really impertinent, but I was real green at the time as far as my experience goes. I said, when you sell this book, would you tell me? And would you tell me how much? And 2 days later, he called and he said he had sold it for $3,000. And
mm-hmm.
that was the point at which I decided I was going to become a bookseller, because obviously he had made a phone call and $2,000
mm-hmm.
had magically appeared. And the way his life was set up, it just was extremely attractive to me. And I kept, I was teaching in Kalamazoo at the time, and I kept teaching until 1984, when the woman in my life had gotten a job at Linfield College in McMinnville here in Oregon. And then I moved here in 1984 and gave up teaching and went into bookselling full time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it all started.
Well, I just love that. And something that strikes me about life is that your life can turn on some chance encounter. And my example is, not that this happened, but I think I talk about being in line at the supermarket and you bump somebody with your cart and they turn around and you strike up a conversation, and who knows where that will go. You know, so just things happen when you're open to the world. And obviously it did in your case. So there's a couple of things I want to just ask you about. I went to your website. I looked at the pictures, and I'm sorry, I did do that, but what I want to talk about is the Statesman's Journal article where I looked at the pictures, and I saw you handling these without gloves, and I didn't know how fragile are these, and there's probably not one answer, probably some are more than others, but I was surprised to see you handling that without gloves. Apparently that's okay.
Well, fingers have fingertips have oil in them, and
mm-hmm.
if you turn a page for every day for generations, that page is going to deteriorate. I had a 15th century choir book that I bought once that where that obviously had happened. Monks had turned the pages while the choir book was being looked at and sung from, and it had happened over and over and over again, and the corners had gotten ragged, and somebody had patched the corners with little pieces of vellum, because the choir book was made out of vellum, as is usually the case. And it turned out, just incidentally, that those patches were from an 8th century manuscript, which made the little patches at the corner worth more than the whole manuscript from the 15th century was, even though that manuscript had gorgeous historiated initials with people in them. But as long as the only vulnerable point in a book is the joint, and
the spine.
Books are badly designed, and if you take a book and you violently throw the cover open, that joint can possibly get damaged. But you talk about gloves, reminds me of, I was hired to do the appraisal of the John Wilson Room books at the Multnomah County Public Library in Portland, and they have a copy of the Audubon Birds of America, which is probably the most valuable printed book that there is. And and I was required to wear white gloves to turn the pages. The problem was the only size glove they had was like size 1, and my my hand, which was perfectly functional before I put the glove on, became a claw once I put the, the size 1 glove on, and I was much more dangerous. Anyway, as long as you use your head, you don't put books in the bathroom, you don't put them in the basement, you don't put the, you don't hang illuminated leaves on the wall in sunlight, it's hard to damage. It's hard to damage these things.
That's okay. Well, that's interesting. And while you were talking there, I thought about, you talked about the most valuable book. In Lincoln City, which is not so awfully far from here, I saw an original, or I guess the first edition, Wizard of Oz. And I asked the fellow about that, and he said it's he had it priced at $100,000. Now, maybe that was just an easy number to get me out of the store, but I don't know. You know, maybe it's worth that. Maybe somebody will pay it.
Well,
and that's kind of a different arena, I think, than what you deal with.
You're right to use that phrase, an antique, and that's what we're talking about when we're talking about antiquarian books. An antique is worth whatever someone will pay for it. The Wizard of Oz first edition is not a particularly rare book, and $100,000 is a very ambitious price for that, unless it's just a sensational copy that, you know, was owned by Judy Garland or something like that.
Right, right. So I was thinking about your business, and again, it is just fascinating on the face of it, but in a metaphorical way, these are, I thought about them like gold. And at some point, it's a finite commodity, like gold is a finite commodity. And have all the rare books, do you think, have been discovered? Are there new things that people find? Or are they all out there and sort of cataloged and now at this point be just being traded back and forth?
Well, it's interesting that to consider that. As it's a very good question, because in the time that I have been a bookseller, and that's 35 years, there's been a change, almost like a sea change. When I first began, institutions were buying, and the movement was from private libraries that came on the market. Heirs were interested in turning books into money, into institutions, and we were building up library collections. Now, mostly because libraries are interested in electronic media, there's a whole lot of deaccessioning taking place from libraries. And whereas once an ex-library copy had a real stigma, more and more in the marketplace, people are just learning to accept that as a kind of fact of life. So there, you're right in saying that it's a finite commodity, but the books will keep shifting, I think, and it may very well be that There is a trend in the right now and going into the future where private owners are recognizing, you know, a Kindle is one thing, but, you know, okay, first edition of Wizard of Oz or first edition of Newton's Principia or first edition of Darwin or whatever, the real object, that's something quite different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I think, a trade. It's an occupation that will continue. It's a strange occupation in that most booksellers are growing older and older. Most collectors, at least, you know, the majority, are elderly. But it's actually a very good opportunity. The occupation represents a very good opportunity for younger people to jump into it. For some reason, it doesn't have the kind of sexiness that other occupations have, but I guess that's understandable because it's an electronic age. It's not an age where people read Latin and Greek and know the difference between an octavo and a quarto and a folio.
Well, I think the number of people probably is not large compared to, you know, some other profession, but I have to think that even, you know, age aside, that it's got to be fascinating for a significant group of people, which leads me to, and because I read this in your article, Cokie Anderson. I don't know her. I don't know if she's young or not, but she is your assistant. Is that correct?
Yeah, she's 50 years old, and she is the chief cataloger.
Okay.
She has a master's in library science, and she spent 10 years actually doing digitization at Oklahoma State University. And she's an articulate and intelligent and knowledgeable person who's a good writer, and those are what it takes to to catalog books. And she's also good on the computer. The wonderful thing about the development of the internet for us, it helps us sell books. But the wonderful thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that it makes research so much easier. And she is very good at that. She's better at it than I am.
Mm-hmm. When I first, again, the suggestion was that I contact you, and I learned a little bit, and looked on your website, not to be crass at all, but these are not comic books, or they're not, they cost a lot. They cost a lot, in at least relative to what I'm used to. And what I thought was, I know you live in a smallish town, and I just suspect that it's not the local people who buy these things. So then I read about Cokie going to France, and that this really is a worldwide business, both buying and selling. I guess it has to be.
Yeah, you're right. And again, it's because it's a very specialized endeavor, a very specialized occupation. Just incidentally, as a kind of correction in a way, we sell things for $50. We also sell things for much more than that. But we still try to sell to a range of people whose pocketbooks are of different sizes. We have 2,000 people that we send our catalogs to, and some of them can only afford to make very modest purchases. At the same time, you know, it gives us a very special pleasure to deal with books that have considerable value. They have considerable value because there's something special, something exciting about them. They played an important role in the history of you know, intellectual history or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We never get tired of finding books that have a special story. That's the whole thing. There are two sources of pleasure in the work I do, as far as I'm concerned. One is the quest, finding the books, and that's where, you know, building up relationships around the world, being in touch with auction houses around the world, finding out what other dealers are offering when we go to book fairs and so on, the quest, finding the books, and then the second thing is doing the research that allows us to create value. Somebody will have a book that they don't understand, and I'm not talking about little old ladies, I'm talking about dealers who may not specialize in antiquarian material, for example, or even ones who do, but they're just not they're not careful enough, or they're not willing to do the work, or they're not good enough at doing the work. And that's the fun. I mean, you find a person's signature on a title page. Well, to me, it's irresistible, the inclination to find out who that person is and whether that person might be important. And it's remarkable how many times the value of a book we have becomes greater because of who owned it. And that's obviously a very important part of the story of a book.
And I would guess then that you have to document that. You have to
be able
to prove that so-and-so had it, sure.
But sometimes what we say is, you know, okay, this is T. Willoughby, and it's a 17th century hand. Well, someone could say, well, it's a 19th century hand, but no, you're wrong. You look at the letters. It's a 17th century hand. All right, now who's T. Willoughby? Well, it's probably Thomas Willoughby. And if it's Thomas Willoughby, then it's probably Thomas Willoughby, who was the son of Francis Willoughby, the great ornithologist. And Thomas Willoughby was a parliamentarian, and he a member of the Royal Society, and blah, 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 blah. And we don't say we know for sure. We just say it seems to make sense, particularly given the book where he's put his name in.
Well, there's so many things I want to ask, and I don't want to run out of time. So just quickly, we talked about your range of customers. I know in the article there was one particular customer named, and that is Jay Walker. I would like you to talk about him a little bit, but let me say that I went to his site and looked up the Walker Library of the History of Human Imagination, and it is beyond impressive. I want to put the link for that on my website and also, of course, the link for Parageous. But can you talk a little bit about Jay Walker?
Well, that would take me a long time to tell the whole story.
But
basically, 14 years ago, I was in the right place at the right time. He began collecting in a serious way antiquarian books at that time, and he decided that the best thing to collect for him as a beginner was editions of the Bible, because it's the world's greatest bestseller. And it just so happened, and the story of how it so happened is really very interesting, and call me back and we can talk about that. It just so happened that I had a really massive collection of early antiquarian Bibles. I had 40 Bibles from the 15th century, which is just, that's almost unheard of. And so I'm sure he sat down and typed into his computer antiquarian Bibles, and our name came up. We had this catalog full of Bibles. He said, send me a copy. We thought it was a hoax. Jay Walker sounds like a made-up name, like lukewarm, you know?
Sure.
But we said, well, it's only going to cost us $5 to send the catalog, so we sent it, and he made an order that was bigger than sometimes the whole catalog brings us in. And then we said, well, we'll believe it when the check arrives, which it did the next day. And one thing led to another. He asked if I would be his advisor, and then I've basically been a person who's helped him these last 14 years to build up this library. And it's been an absolutely amazing ride, because I was very happy doing what I was doing before I met him, but after having met him, I've been able to deal with books that are very expensive and very special, and it has allowed me to meet other dealers who were buying and selling these expensive and exciting books well before I was, and plus, it's made me a very, what shall I say, People invite me to dinner because I know Jay Walker.
Sure.
And they're interested in making sales to him. In any case, it's been a very it's been a wonderful experience. He's been a prince as far as you know, interpersonal relations, because sometimes dealers who or collectors who spend a lot of money can be quite demanding and thoughtless, and he's the farthest thing from it.
Yeah. And if I just might, as a shorthand presentation, say Jay Walker, among many, many other things, was a founder of Priceline.com.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the tip of the iceberg. Well, lots to, and I'm just going to ask you right now if we can't do this again, because there's so much. But before I let you go, I know you and your wife started the Give a Little Foundation. And it's so important, and it does such great work. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, my wife worked for Linfield College for 18 years and then retired. And she's always been inclined to help people who are in need. And in 2008, she, I, and a woman named Tricia Crawford established the Give a Little Foundation, and people who want to know a little bit more about us just can go to givealittlefoundation.org on the internet and see what we do. And the Statesman Journal article did a very nice job of linking my work to the work of the foundation, because in the beginning we were simply going to use my income to fund the operation of the Give a Little Foundation. Since then, now we have been getting support from outside donors, partly through fundraisers. But in the 6 years that we've been going, we have been providing more and more help for more and more needy folks. What we do, we're a second-line organization. We don't deal directly with clients because we don't have the staff.
Right.
But there are some 20 organizations, government, church, other miscellaneous referral organizations that deal directly with clients who need help. And what we do is we give money to these people funneled through these frontline organizations that for various reasons cannot provide the funds. Sometimes there's restrictions on what they're allowed to provide. Sometimes they run out of money. In other words, these people fall through the cracks. And we give small, one-time grants that are intended to help people who are in emergencies. And we've seen really very gratifying results. Frequently, people get this money at a time when it's absolutely crucial to staying off the street or keeping employed or getting away from an abusive spouse or whatever. And we in the first year we helped, I think, 20 people, and now we're helping almost one person a day with a grant, and then we're also helping with bus passes and co-pays for appointments, for medical appointments, summer camps, and a lot of other things too. So it's a wonderful foundation. The needs haven't lessened. In fact, the more people know about us, the more demands there are on our resources. So we're always interested in meeting people who are willing to donate to the cause.
Sure. Well, you and I, we've not met, but we're nearly neighbors. At least we live in the same general area. And I think it would be fair to say that this is an economically depressed area. My wife has worked for the Community Compassion Fund, which is a similar kind of an organization, and she relates the same thing. And there are people who come in who are, I guess I would say, embarrassed or uncomfortable because they're the ones that up till now have always helped somebody else, but through some turn of events, there was that one missed payment or a job opportunity, but they just couldn't get there. And so, you know, congrats congratulations to you and Ellen for what you do. And just in closing, I want to give Ellen a plug. She is a poet as well, and in fact, I have her book, Haunted, and mm-hmm. which was a gift from Joyce Wolcott, who I suspect you know. And congratulations to her.
Thank you. I will pass that on. She actually has a second volume called In the Same Pod, and anybody who wants to buy it can go to Third Street Books, and there it is. And it's the proceeds go to the Give a Little Foundation.
Sure. Well, thank you so much. And I'm going to take you up on your offer. I'd love to finish up. I had a list of questions and things that I wanted to ask and have you comment on. Let's just save that for another time.
Okay.
In the meantime, I'm going to put three links on my website, which is stephenwlong.com, to your website, Parageous.com, which is for the books, the Give a Little Foundation, and the Jay Walker link, too. It's just, I was going to ask you if you'd actually been there, and apparently you have, but it's breathtaking. I just couldn't believe the room that these works are housed in.
I've been there half a dozen times, and it's kind of like, well, you see pictures of the Grand Canyon, and you say, oh, my God, you know. But then when you actually go there, it's a whole different thing.
Exactly. Well, God bless you. You guys are doing great stuff.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for giving me a call.
We'll do it again.
Okay.
Folks, yeah. So love to hear from you at stephenwlong.com. That's my website. The Facebook page is There's a Somebody. You can contact me through there. If you'd like to know more about Phil, we can hook you guys up. What else? Give me suggestions for somebody that you'd like to see interviewed. And we will talk to you next week. Thanks.
Left you on the debris at the Sunday morning market. You were starting through the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door. That old familiar love song. Gosh, you knew you'd find me waiting there at the top of the stairs. Trouble at the depot with the General Workers Union, and yet that they'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working. but I left you on the debris. Now we both know you got the money, and I wonder what you would have done.